Welcome to this Sunday morning's message podcast from Kingdom Faith.
Shall I take my stuff?
Yeah. Morning, everyone. How are you doing? Morning. Look, I'm going to add loads of paper to this. Right. Hello, I'm Dave. Pleased to meet you. Everyone knows a Dave, don't they? And if you don't, you do now. Hey! Andrea said something this morning. God really does love you. She had us say it to our neighbours, didn't she? We're going to look at that this morning. She didn't know we were going to pick up on that. So I'm going to pick up on that and say, God really does love you. And we're going to look at that through the lens of suffering. It's not the most obvious lens, but it's the lens that we have available to us today. We're starting this theme, or we're not starting it, we're in the middle of it now, because it's a 3-week thing, or on week 2. We're in the middle of a theme on answering difficult questions. And I think one of the most difficult questions that I ever get asked goes something along the lines of, if there's a God of love, why ... Why did this happen? Why did that happen? Why, if there's a God of love, how can God allow suffering? We're going to try and answer some of that question this morning. I say some, firstly because I am humble about my abilities as a communicator, and I don't think I'm going to answer all your questions in any way, shape or form. I also don't think we have enough time. You would need a lifetime to answer this question. You would also need the comprehension of the dear Lord himself to be able to answer this question. Because some of things we just don't know. And do you know what, when you don't know the answer to a question, do you know what the best answer you can give someone is? I don't know. Yeah. Be honest. Sometimes we just don't know. And in those instances, I love a quote from a bloke called Oz Guinness. You might have heard of his family, if you've not heard of him, because he is from that family. Oz Guinness says, there are times when we may be in the dark about what God is doing, but we're not in the dark about God. And there are times when we might need to hold on to that. That God, I don't know what you're doing or how you're doing it, because your ways are higher than my ways, your thoughts are higher than my thoughts. But I'm not in the dark about you. I know who you are. And because I know who you are, I know I can walk through this valley of the shadow of whatever on earth it wants to be. Yeah? My name's Dave. I'm the youth director at Kingdom Faith Church, which means I look after the young people. And our session today with the young people probably didn't sound the most exciting, talking about stained glass windows, but I promise you it is a good one. I don't like to give away what we're going to talk about out there, like with the young people, before we actually get going. It seems a shame to spoil it all by telling everyone before they actually go out. So sometimes we tell them something that isn't the most exciting and then give them a surprise when they get out there. So, suffering. What's the best answer to the question of suffering? Firstly, that's the wrong question. Do you remember last week? I'm sure at some point Andrew would have said something along the lines of, we're there to answer the questioner, not necessarily their question. And sometimes people give us these questions that aren't actually good questions at all. You know, all people are equal. All people. Genesis 1:27, we're all made in the image of God. All people are equal and are of equal value. But all thoughts and ideas and questions are not. Some thoughts, ideas and questions are actually terrible. Like really bad. I mean, some people used to ask me a question when I was at school, which was a really hard one. Does your mother know you're stupid? Now, how do I get out of that? Yes, my mother does know I'm stupid. No, my mother has not yet found out that I'm stupid. I mean, how do you get out of it? Sometimes all people are of equal value before God. Not all questions, thoughts and ideas are. But I don't want to answer this question straight away. Why do I not want to answer this question straight away? Because there are some questions that we ask, does your mother know you're stupid, which don't require a response, or it doesn't really matter what response we give. There are other questions where it's really important what response we give. They're normally asked to us by customs officials. I always get nervous when going through airports. I don't have any reason to go through airports. My life is not exciting enough to get nervous. You know, I've got nothing to carry with me, but it always intimidates me. I once got interrogated by a TSA agent in America, and that's enough to just terrify anyone. I was only 16 at the time, bless him. Anyway, enough of that. What's the best response we can give to the answer of why does a God of love allow suffering in the world? Probably something along the lines of, would you like a cup of tea? Why? Because this question isn't being asked in abstraction, is it? And we can be asked a lot of questions in abstraction about what do you think about this? What do you think about this? What are the potential, you know, unintended consequences of Brexit? There are some questions which are head questions, aren't there? There are other questions which are heart questions. They're felt questions, aren't they? And I think suffering probably goes beyond heart, straight down into hurt. Because this question is always asked by a person or about a person, isn't it? And so the correct response isn't, this is your lucky day. I've heard a Sunday on this and we're going to answer and solve all your riddles and mysteries about suffering. No, you won't. You probably won't. But let me walk with you. Can I offer you a cup of tea? Can I spend some time with you? Would you like me to pray for you? Is there anything I can do for you? Like, literally do for you. Can I come round the house and help tidy up? You know, what's happened that I can actually help with? And where am I getting my biblical justification for this response? Well, James chapter 2, verse 14 to 17 says this. What good is it, dear brothers and sisters, if you say you have a faith, but don't show it by your actions? Can that kind of faith save anyone? Suppose you see a brother or sister who has no food or clothing, and you say, goodbye, have a good day, stay warm and eat well. But then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? So you see, faith by itself isn't enough unless it produces good deeds. It's dead and useless. We don't want to be those people who get accused of having dead and useless faith. We want to be those people who, when we see need, however it presents itself, whether it being in cold or hunger, and we actually actively respond to it. Firstly, would you like a cup of tea? Would you like someone to listen to you? Would you like me to sit with you or walk with you through this journey? How can a God of love allow suffering in this world? At the heart of the question, there's a cry. There's an injustice, isn't there? There's this sense of, how can this be? Well, this just isn't right. It's buried inside that question. Don't run from that, because that actually helps us. That little presupposition that's smuggled into the question itself will help you. It helps me understand it. There's a man that some of you might know of called Ravi Zacharias who explains that he unpacks that very well. He says this. There cannot be the question, right? He's answering the question. There cannot be a God because there's too much evil in the world. Here's the problem with that objection. When you say there's too much evil, you have assumed that there is good. And when you assume there is good, you assume there is such a thing as a moral law on the basis of which to judge between good and evil. And if you assume a moral law, then you must posit a moral law giver. Well, that's who you're trying to disprove and not prove. So because if there's no moral law giver, there's no moral law. And if there's no moral law, then there is no good. And if there's no good, then there is no evil. Now, that philosophical question will not solve your friend's struggle with their friend's illness or their parent's illness or maybe their own illness. But it does help us filter our own thoughts in the way we respond. So let's quickly take a moment to reframe pain. Anyone here work in a hospital? Hey! Hello, Dan. Why at this time of year do we have more cases of burnt hands than any other time of year? I mean, and I know this is like the time of year when we have the radiators on. So Dave, come on, ask a silly question, get a silly answer. Why do we get more cases of burnt hands at this time of year? Students are all resisting the urge to answer because I've done this lecture with them last week in the college. It's because why? People, not us of course, but people we know go out drinking of an evening and they come back in and they're cold and so they put their hands on the radiator and sit on them. And the alcohol, which they've put into their system, does what? Does alcohol make you more aware of what's going on Or does it slightly suppress what's going on in the world around you? Slightly suppresses it, doesn't it? So the trigger warning that your hands are getting from the radiator to say, oi, get off, that's hot, is being prevented, isn't it? And so you sit on your hands too long and you get burnt hands. So in that instance, is the pain a good thing or a bad thing? The pain's a good thing, right? The pain is to prevent worse damage. The pain is to stop something that's actually serious going on. But we've suppressed that with the alcohol, as I say. Not us, someone we know. Probably someone further down the street. I don't want to drag your good names of the Worthing congregation down into that. And yet, still it's the dream of every five-year-old boy, isn't it, to be a superhero who feels no pain. Right, I mean, you'll see my boys, they're little blonde ones, they're just like these little mops running around this hair. I used to join them in that many years ago. I also had a mop of blonde hair. It's hard to believe it now, but it did exist. I have photos to prove it. every five-year-old boy wants to believe that if they felt no pain, they'd be a superhero. And yet, curiously, there is a girl in America called Ashlyn Blocker who feels no pain. She has a condition called CEPA, the congenital insensitivity to pain, with anhidrosis, which means she can't feel pain and she doesn't sweat. Now, is she a superhero? No. It's actually very, very serious. Because she can't feel pain, she's vulnerable, not all-powerful. She's not Supergirl or Superman. She's, in fact, somebody that needs to be looked after very carefully by her parents because she doesn't know that she's hurt herself. That's tricky. That means when she goes out into the playground at playtime, teachers have to watch her to make sure she hasn't fallen over and cut her knee. She'll be aware she fell over because maybe she didn't win the race, but she wouldn't be aware of the trickle of blood running down her leg just because she can't feel the pain. Google her if you want to know more about it. It's a fascinating story. Ashlyn's mum, what's her prayer every night? God, would you let my daughter feel pain? And of course, mine and every other parent in the room, our prayer every day is, God, could you please prevent my child from feeling pain? Right? Because we don't want that. But if it isn't there, we do want that. So this subject, we need to approach with a lot of humility. It's not simple. It's quite complex. There's no easy answers. And for me, my personal relationship with pain or suffering is that I can't be mad at it. Because if suffering didn't exist, neither would I. I'll tell you why. My parents wanted three kids. And my parents have three kids. I'm the third of three, the youngest, the tallest, and currently in a competition to be the fattest. We're all competing quite well. We've all put in a good effort, to be fair. And it's probably a tie, if I'm honest. But I am the tallest, so I carry it off better. I say that only for the benefit of them, if they bother to listen to this. Hi, Adam and Matt. Hi, Adam and Matt. So I have an oldest brother, Matt, and he's currently the shortest. And so he lives out in Bosnia, if you're curious about that. So he's the oldest. Then there's a three-year gap. Then there's my middle brother, Adam, and he lives out in Cape Town. And then there's a three-year gap. And then there's the miscarriage that my parents had. And then there's a one-year gap, and then there's me. I can't be mad at suffering. Because if suffering didn't exist, neither would I. Now, I had to sit down and talk to my mum about that incident only a couple of weeks ago, because we happened to be taking my dad to hospital. And it was very interesting talking to her about it. It's very humbling to know that life is in a balance. I may not be here right now. That's the truth, right? It's humbling. But all good apologetics, all good answers to the question, focus on who? Jesus. And the offer that Jesus gives us is unlike any offer in any other belief or any other faith or any other system in the world. And we're going to take a whistle stop through just some of that. You may know some Muslims and what they believe. They even believe in Jesus. Jesus is a prophet in Islam. But because he's a prophet in Islam, it is offensive that Allah would have allowed him to suffer, or that he would have allowed him to be killed. It is explicitly in the Quran. They killed him not, they crucified him not. That's the only verse in the Quran I have memorized. And actually, I've lost my copy of the Quran. If anyone has it, can you give it back? It's genuinely true. That's not even a joke. Muslims find it so offensive that Allah would have been neglectful in allowing Jesus to suffer that it is written in the Quran, they killed him not, they crucified him not. Right? So what's the Muslim view? Inshallah, if God wills it. If God wills it, it'll happen. So I don't know why you would want to pray as a Muslim to be healed, because if God wills it, it'll happen, and if God wills it, it won't happen. There's no hope there. There's no inspiration for looking for something to actually come to you, because I don't know where you're going to get that faith from. It just doesn't exist in their text. What about Buddhists? Buddhists, the whole aim of their life is to remove, not pain, desire. Your pain isn't your problem. Your desire for it to go is. You see, we get sold this mis version of Buddhism in the West, especially if you go to Brighton. And this view of Buddhism that, like, everything's cool, everything's fine, and when you reach nirvana, it's going to be like the most amazing thing ever. That's completely false. When you reach nirvana, you die. The goal of nirvana is actually being extinguished from life, because life is so infuriating that you keep on being born and reborn. It's frustrating for them to keep going around in circles, because they haven't solved the problem of how to remove all the desire in their life. So if they're sick, your problem isn't your sickness, your problem is that you haven't learnt to ignore your sickness, to remove the desire to be healed. But I don't see how that helps. I mean, any fool can sit in a corner and ignore things. And most of us know what happens when we do. They get worse, don't they? So telling me that my problem is that I desire for things to change doesn't help me. It makes things worse. Hindus also believe in this karma, this birth and rebirth, that every sickness and suffering is paying for something that you've done in a previous life. And that just puts this insurmountable works in front of me that I have to work to be better, to be better, to be better. And the sickness that I have is my fault. Atheists often claim that suffering is their best argument against the Christian God, because how could an all-knowing, all-loving God allow suffering to happen in the world that he created? But their solution to that suffering is almost identical to the Muslim solution. Things just are the way they are. Well, I don't know what you can invoke to change them. You can't invoke anything, can you? There's nothing to invoke. All we've got is matter and energy. So actually, their answer that things just are sounds to me very Muslim, inshallah. If God wills it, just without using God. Richard Dawkins says that DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we just dance to its music. Thanks, Rich. We'll file that under heartless, shall we? There's no hope there, because there can't be. You can't find it somewhere. But Jesus isn't like that. Now, let's start with Luke 13 and work from there. And this is a really poignant example because of what happened 2 weeks ago in Texas. So Luke 13 says, at about this time, Jesus was informed that Pilate had murdered some people from Galilee as they were offering sacrifices at the temple. That sounds exactly like what happened 2 weeks ago in Sutherland Springs in Texas, doesn't it? Jesus asked, do you think those Galileans were worse sinners than the other people from Galilee? Is that why they suffered? No, not at all. And you will perish too unless you repent of your sins and turn to God. And what about the 18? This is Jesus ratcheting up the ante. He then says, what about the 18 people who died when the Tower of Siloam fell on them? Were they the worst sinners in Jerusalem? No. And I tell you that unless you repent, you will perish too. Jesus isn't being insensitive or harsh with his disciples. But he has to jolt them out of a false way of thinking. R.C. Sproul says this, "We do well to receive his jolt with gladness, for it helps us see things from an eternal perspective when we can deal with catastrophes, in this world only by understanding that behind them stands the eternal purposes of God and by realizing that he has delivered us from the ultimate catastrophe, the collapse of the tower of his final judgment on our heads." There's a lie that goes around in culture, which we borrow from the East, of karma. If you do good things, good things will happen to you. If you do bad things will happen to you. Jesus disagrees. Jesus says these people were doing a good thing and a bad thing happened. Which is a reminder, not that karma is or isn't a good thing, it's a reminder that we need to have our focus on what is of primary importance. And what is of primary importance? God. It's more important than whether I'm perceived as a good or a bad person. Karma tricks us into thinking that matter and energy and what I get and what I receive in my life is of more importance to me than actually God's view of me. It's like we're trying to live to please what happens next. There's this question, why do bad things happen to good people? Isn't there? Psalm 73 asks the opposite question. Why do bad things happen to good people? That's what Psalm 73's wrestle is. Well, Jesus, what is his approach? What does he do when he sees this world? Well, in this instant here of the temple, he's taken two different types of suffering and he's put them into one illustration. He said there's the suffering of free will, and there's the suffering of a so-called natural disaster. The free will was these people, under the orders of Pilate, had chosen, they had the choices laid before them to do good or bad, and they'd chosen to do something bad. Right? Suffering of free will. And then there's natural disasters. So-called why? Well, if you think of an earthquake or a volcano or a tectonic plate shift, when David Attenborough is making a film about them and there's no people present, what do we call them? Amazing. Incredible. Look at this volcano. It's amazing. And what do we call them when there's people present? Disaster. Terrible. The worst things. There's been some pretty hefty hurricanes and things earlier on this year, hasn't there? And Jesus doesn't say, yeah, karma. It's because they're bad people. He doesn't say that. Luke 13, he says, it's a reminder to us that we all need to keep ourselves right with God. But he doesn't say it's judgment from God. Jesus wants to solve this issue that we have with suffering. And what's his primary method of doing that? Well, this time of year, I went shopping a little bit. At the weekend, you know, as you do, you wander around the shops a little bit. And what do you start seeing around you? Other than nonsense. Christmas stuff, right? Christmas stuff. And occasionally you'll even see the word Christmas. And at Christmas time, as Christians, we are reminded that Jesus is our what? Our It's not a new language. I'm just trying to get you to say Emmanuel. Emmanuel. Jesus is our Emmanuel. He's our God who is with us. God with us. Think about this. He condescended to us. He came down to us. He lived amongst us. He suffered like us. And then he dies for us. Comes to us, lives among us, suffers like us, dies for us. Some of you will remember John Stott. He writes this fantastic paragraph in The Cross of Christ, which I'd love to read to you. I could never myself believe in God if it were not for the cross. The only God I believe in is the one that Nietzsche ridiculed as the God of the cross. In this real world of pain, how could one worship a God who is immune to it? I've entered many Buddhist temples in different Asian countries and stood respectfully before the statue of the Buddha, his legs crossed, arms folded, eyes closed, the ghost of a smile playing around his mouth, but a remote look on his face, detached from the agonies of the world. But each time, after a while, I've had to turn away, and in imagination I've turned instead to that lonely, twisted, tortured figure on the cross, nails through hands and feet, back lacerated, limbs wrenched, brow bleeding from thorn pricks, mouth dry and intolerably thirsty, plunged into God-forsaken darkness. That is the God for me. He laid aside his immunity to pain. He entered our world of flesh and blood, tears and death. He suffered for us. Our sufferings become more manageable in the light of his. There is still a question mark against human suffering, but over it, we boldly stamp another mark, the cross, which symbolizes divine suffering, the cross of Christ. Suffering reminds us that we live in a fallen world and that we need redemption. Jesus' life reminds us that unlike every invented God, Jesus never separated himself from our suffering, and he even suffered for us. Right at the beginning of the Bible, you see that Hagar describes God as the God who sees. When she's isolated and feeling like the whole world's come against her, you're the God who sees. David, Psalm 56, verse 8, says a very curious phrase. It's like you catch my tears in your bottle and you've numbered every one of them in your book. I don't imagine God has a little thimble jar like shelf in heaven where he's actually got all of David's tears. But David has that sense that God is not isolated from him, but he's close enough to have caught all his tears in his bottle. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe God does have like a medicine cabinet of tears in heaven. I don't know. The point is, he sees, he knows, he understands. He's not separate. He's close. He's Emmanuel. He's God with us, not God separate from us or God who finds it offensive that he should be suffering. He's God with us. Jesus never hides suffering from us. The Sermon on the Mount, at the conclusion of it, Matthew 7, Jesus finishes up all of this wonderful teaching with a curious illustration, and it goes like this. Matthew 7, verse 24. Because anyone who listens to my teaching and follows it is wise, like a person who builds a house on solid rock. Though the rain comes and in torrents and floodwaters rise and the winds beat against the house, it won't collapse because it's built on bedrock. But anyone who hears my teaching and doesn't obey is foolish, like a person who builds a house on sand. Where rains and floods come and the winds beat against the house, it will collapse with a mighty crash. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowd were amazed at his teaching, for he taught with real authority, quite unlike their teachers of religious law. We have two houses. We have two builders. We have one storm. Two houses, two builders, two foundations, one storm. Jesus doesn't say that the builder who built his house on the rock somehow built it so high that it was above the weather systems and there was no rain, no wind, no buffeting, no storm. And that it was just the silly guy who built it on the sand. His house fell down because he was silly enough to not build it up on the high rock. No. Jesus didn't say that. Jesus said that it did go through the storm. That it did suffer, if you will, that it did have wind and rain beat down upon it, but that it did stay standing. Because of what? Because of what it was built on. Because of, fundamentally, Jesus. Because God with us. Jesus carries him through the storm, whereas the shifting sands of opinion and time, they fall away beneath us. Jesus reveals himself to us as this Emmanuel, God with us. He associates himself in proximity with our pain. But then also he associates himself with our pain in another way, which sometimes I know I've overlooked. In Acts 9, there's a story of Saul heading along a road to Damascus. And it says this in Acts 9, verse 3. As Saul was approaching Damascus on this mission, a light from heaven suddenly shone down around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice saying, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" "Who are you, Lord?" Saul asks. And the voice replied, "I am Jesus, the one you are persecuting. Now get up and go to the city and you'll be told what you must do." Think about this story. If you remember it, who is Saul persecuting? The church. Christians. You and me. He's persecuting Christians. What's Jesus' response to him persecuting Christians? "Why are you persecuting me?" "Who are you, Lord?" "I am Jesus, the one you are persecuting." "Never heard of you, Jesus. I was killing these Christian folks, these followers of the way. I was getting those guys." Jesus doesn't just associate with our pain in an abstract sense. He takes ownership of it. That suffering that they felt, he felt. It's like he was close enough to catch their tears in a bottle. He's the God that saw when they felt isolated and lonely. Far from killing off God and my faith in God, suffering and God's response to it actually strengthens my faith. Doesn't mean I don't have questions. I had to drive my dad to hospital a couple of weeks ago myself. I have questions. But when I'm in the dark about what God is doing, I'm not in the dark about God. Remember, when we get asked these questions by our friends about how can a God of love allow suffering in the world, they're answering it about a person. They're not asking it in abstraction because they'd love to philosophically know why a loving God might be able to allow suffering. That's not what they're driving at. What they're driving at there is they have a relative or a friend or they themselves is suffering. That's why we need to answer their question with help. That help that we talked about from the James session. The best response may well be a cup of tea in half an hour of your time. Your life may be the only Bible your friend has to read. Be good news to them in their situation. Be the gospel to them. In the Christian worldview, or just in the Christian story, the crucifixion is followed by the resurrection. Death is followed by new life. Don't buy into the lie of this age that tells us that matter and energy, the stuff that we can weigh, measure, put in a lab and dissect, that's the only stuff that counts. It's not true. We believe in a God of justice who will judge all men for the actions that they have made, and also offers us a life of true freedom for those that trust in him. Our hope is secure. That hope that we talked about last week from 1 Peter 3:15, our hope is secure. But our hope also reaches its final fullness and conclusion beyond the grave. We know him now, But we will know him even as we are known on that day. We may face difficulties in this life, but they are nothing as compared to what is ahead of us. I said at the beginning that I will struggle to answer all your questions, and I'm sure for some of you, I have given you more questions than I've given you answers, and God bless you. They are yours to have and to hold and to wrestle with. I've shared with you today some of my personal wrestles and some of my personal struggles, if you will, with this topic and this subject. But I'm convinced of two things. And these are two things that I tell our young people all the time. God is good, and your life matters. God is good. How do I know this? How do I know this? Romans 5. While I was still a sinner, Christ did what? Died for me. Just the fact that Christmas is coming and we've got the Emmanuel ringing around our heads all the time, or it's in our thoughts, that Jesus wanted to solve the issue of our separation with God by coming down to be God with us, shows me that he's good and that you matter to him. I think that's me. If you would love to ask me a question afterwards, I would love to talk to you. Better yet, I'd love to help you, or get a friend to help you, to get, you know, stuck into the Bible and ask God, God, can you show me what's going on? It's times like this when we get forced to do something. I'm forgetting the scripture verse exactly now, but we have a choice, don't we? We can be anxious for everything, or we can be anxious for nothing. But in everything, we can, yes, make a request known to God, but also just take time to be with him. So in everything, make time for God. Just like in Psalm 73, when Asaph's having a freak out, and he's going, I see this happening, and I see this happening, and I don't understand why good things are happening to bad people, and did I keep myself pure for nothing? Like, how come I'm the good guy here, in my own self-righteousness, right? And I'm suffering, or I'm having bad things happen, and it isn't until he gets to verse 17 that it says, and then I went into your sanctuary. And then the whole tone of the psalm changes. Then everything changes and he starts to see things from God's perspective. Yes, suffering is hard. But yes, it's an opportunity to come close to God and to see things from his perspective. When we see things from his perspective, everything changes. Rory, can I ask you to come up? Is that all right, fella? We'll do a song in a moment. This may well have churned some stuff up for you, and I'm not your guy to sort that out. God is. I'd really, really happily talk to you afterwards, and I'm sure the pastors and leaders here will be really happy to talk to you afterwards too. But our focus is on Jesus. He's Emmanuel. He's God with us. Not God distant from us. Not God unobtainably far away from us. Not God who reckons that we should just dissolve our desire to see anything change at all and we should just go and sit in a corner. Not God who says, it's so offensive to me to think that you would want me to suffer that I will actually write it specifically in my holy book that never happened. No. God doesn't deny our suffering. He doesn't run from our suffering. He shares. I don't know what response you need to make to God today. Maybe there's some suffering going on in your life. I'd ask you to give it to him. And as a family this morning, I'd ask you to be aware of the folks around you. Let's not be those guys who after the service put our arm around each other and say, goodbye, have a good day, stay warm, eat well, and do nothing, just like was said in James. But let's be the body today. Let's look out for one another. today. So as we see, as we're mingling and mixing at the back in the hub afterwards, let's be observant of those around us. It's our love for one another that sets us apart from everyone else. Apparently, that's how everyone will know that we're his disciples, right? That's also smuggled in the Bible, isn't it? So Roy's going to play, and you can join in singing with him if you want. I'd like you just to take a couple of minutes just to respond in your heart. I don't know what response you need to make. It's different for everyone, I imagine. But I know what my response is. God, I am thankful for your goodness today. God, I am thankful for who you are, that you never change.
Thank you for listening to this Kingdom Faith podcast. We trust it's been an encouragement to you. For more information and resources by Kingdom Faith and for our other audio and video podcasts, please visit kingdomfaith.com.